on Tuesday, 20th of April. For almost a year, George Floyd's death under the knee of a police officer has reverberated around the world, inspiring murals and marches, sparking conversations in living rooms and new legislation. The statement added, "But a more basic question has always remained. Would justice be done? Defund and abolish police, refund our communities," said in a statement. The establishment wanted to use George Floyd's case and the conviction of Derek Chauvin as evidence that the system can work, offering Chauvin up as the sacrificial lamb to preserve the policing system. But public awareness and the national conversation has moved beyond them to demand more. They said, "In this case at least, we have our answer. But if we're being honest with ourselves, we know that true justice is about much more than a single verdict in a single trial." The Black Lives Matter Global Network Foundation also released a statement in reaction to the verdict. The statement said, "We hope this guilty verdict begins to show that white supremacy will not win. White supremacy has no place in democracy, especially one that is supposed to guarantee us our freedom to live," adding, "But let us also be clear that this still does not bring our loved ones back. We do not get George Floyd back. His daughter and family have to grow up without him. His family continues his legacy through the George Floyd Memorial Foundation." The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP, released a statement noting that efforts to take on police brutality were still far from over. The statement read, "Police are here to protect, not lynch. We will not rest until all in our community have the right to breathe. The chapter on Derek Chauvin may be closed, but the fight for police accountability and respect for black lives is far from over." It was immediately clear to any fair-minded person that Derek Chauvin murdered George Floyd, and it took nearly a year for the US justice system to come to that conclusion. Other high-profile cases of people of color losing their lives at the hands of police have ended with no accountability for the law enforcement in more recent years. Only between the Derek Chauvin trial on 29th of March 2020 and last Saturday, 17th of April 2021, at least 64 people were killed by law enforcement officers nationwide.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says it will force Israel to free Palestinian prisoners. Senior Hamas official Khaled Mash'al said the issue of Palestinian prisoners is a top priority for all Palestinians. Mash'al said Hamas is keen on conveying the prisoners' message to the international community. He underlined the fact that Israel will not release Palestinian prisoners except through resistance by Palestinians and that negotiations are not the way forward. The comments came as Palestinians just marked the Prisoners' Day. On April 17th of each year, Palestinians expressed their loyalty to those imprisoned by the regime and as a reminder of their legitimate struggle for freedom. An estimated 4,500 Palestinians are languishing in Israeli jails, many for simply challenging Israel's occupation. They include 41 women and 140 children below 18 years. Since the beginning of 2021, Israeli authorities have arrested nearly 1,400 Palestinians. Some estimates have put the number of Palestinians to have been jailed at over 1 million.
Well, on the 22nd November 1974, the United Nations General Assembly recognized the right of Palestinian people to self-determination, national independence, and sovereignty of Palestine. And these jailings of the people of Palestine are in complete contradiction to the UN General Assembly resolution. The Palestinians have a right to resist, they have a right for their homeland, and what we've seen is this systematic jailing of Palestinians. Now, whether the resistance is through the PLO, the PFLP, Hamas, the authority, or individual Palestinians is irrelevant. The relevance is that this is a criminalization, not just of a community, but of a whole nation. The figure of 1 million is shocking when we bear in mind that the population of Palestine currently is estimated at 5 million. That means that 20% of the entire population of a nation has been jailed at one particular time. And this figure in itself is shocking. It's a shocking figure, and it's something that should be rejected, and Palestinian people need to be supported in their legal battle and in their right for a homeland.
Palestinian Prisoners' Day comes as nearly 550 inmates suffer from various diseases and require close monitoring and health care. At least 10 inmates suffer from cancer of varying degrees, including Fuad al-Shubaki, 82, the oldest of the prisoners. So far, 368 jailed Palestinians have been infected with the coronavirus. Some Palestinians have spent 40 years in captivity, with 543 sentenced to several life sentences. That brings to the spotlight the fact that the regime continues with its violation of Palestinian human rights.
Palestinians have suffered human rights abuses for decades and decades now. It will only stop when Palestinians have the right to return, when Palestinians have their homeland, and when they can legally control their own destiny. At the moment, Palestinians have very few rights, and this is part of the problem that they've been facing for many years now.
But Tel Aviv's violation of rights does not suffice to that. The regime has kept nearly 3 million Gazans under a tight blockade since 2007. As long as the coronavirus pandemic is concerned, the Israeli regime's inhumane practices have led to a state of de-development within Gaza's healthcare system, making it extremely hard for healthcare workers to combat the coronavirus pandemic. In the occupied West Bank, the regime continues with its other violations, including settlement expansions. But why isn't the international community able to put an end to the Israeli crimes?
Well, the situation in terms of Israel-Palestine is part of a global situation. There are vested interests on both sides, and clearly the power resides against the Palestinians. There are many national organizations, international organizations, and nations who are supporting the Palestinian rights, and they should continue to do so until Palestinians get what they deserve under the UN Convention.
Israel has been violating the rights of Palestinians with impunity since day one of its installment in the region by its Western creators. Tel Aviv enjoys full support from the U.S. in particular. No matter which party's candidate wins the race for the White House in U.S. presidential elections, there is an unwritten tradition in the U.S. foreign policy which regards the Israeli regime as a sacrosanct. In line with that tradition, each and every meaningful effort to call Tel Aviv to account at the UN Security Council over its crimes has been aborted by the U.S. that holds veto power at the world body.
The United States announced last week its plan to withdraw all its troops from Afghanistan. In a White House speech, President Joe Biden said it was time to end Washington's longest war in history.
After consulting closely with our allies and partners, with our military leaders and intelligence personnel, with our diplomats and our development experts, with the Congress and the Vice President, as well as with Mr. Ghani and many others around the world, I've concluded that it's time to end America's longest war. It's time for American troops to come home.
Biden said the withdrawal will begin from May 1st and conclude by September 11 this year. Shortly after his announcement, NATO said in a statement that it will coordinate its troops' withdrawal from Afghanistan with the United States.
In the light of the U.S. decision to withdraw, foreign and defense ministers of NATO discussed the way forward today and decided that we will start the withdrawal of NATO rescue support mission forces by May 1st.
The NATO chief said it is now up to the Afghans to reach sustainable peace. But the U.S. government has kept silent about whether it will also withdraw American private contractors conducting operations there.
So on the contractors, we don't know exactly. There's some preliminary plans. Clearly, the goal is to get all our personnel out. And I suspect that contractors will be part of that. Whether there'll still be a need for some contractor support, I just don't know. We don't have that level of detail right now. We're still working through that.
The New York Times has cited U.S. officials as saying that the U.S. is planning to continue its presence in Afghanistan by keeping the contractors and operatives in the country following the withdrawal of its troops.
Biden is trying to present himself as a new kind of president. And to do that, he has to make some pretend announcements that things are changing. This is one of them.
So why has the U.S. decided to pull out its forces if it's so keen on keeping its military presence there? Washington-linked private security companies have a long history of committing war crimes and interfering in countries around the world. Perhaps one of the most notorious of the American private contractors is Blackwater, now renamed Academy, which has been involved in several major scandals. The most notable was an incident in 2007 in Iraq when four Blackwater security personnel killed 14 civilians, two of whom children. Former U.S. President Donald Trump exacerbated this scandal by pardoning the contractors in his final days in office. But Blackwater is not the only such American firm that is active in conducting high-level overseas operations.
America has approximately 500 military bases around the planet. It has hundreds of major bases, and then it has hundreds of minor bases. So Afghanistan is just one peg in a worldwide network of military bases that the United States uses to put pressure on different regions to support its political, economic, and social goals as an empire.
Back in May 2020, Venezuela arrested 13 individuals charged with planning an operation in the capital, Caracas, two of whom were American nationals. The U.S. mercenaries admitted that they were arrested during a failed attempt to raid Venezuela's presidential palace and seize President Nicolas Maduro. Considering the controversy surrounding the presence of U.S. private security firms abroad, experts believe Washington seeks a lower level of accountability by reducing the number of its declared troops in countries like Afghanistan.
America is an empire. President Biden is the current administrator of that empire. There's a lot of opposition among the people of America to never-ending so-called forever wars.
What's certain is that the United States is unwilling to leave the region, no matter if that would translate into the privatization of its wars in West Asia.
On Saturday, diplomats from the remaining parties to the 2015 nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action agreed to continue the negotiations as well as technical consultations within the next days. At the end of the talks in the Austrian capital, Vienna, Iranian chief nuclear negotiator Abbas Araghchi stressed that differences have not been settled yet. He reiterated that some serious disagreements need to be resolved during next negotiations. The senior Iranian diplomat's remarks were in line with what the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, previously said. The leader had earlier warned against protracted talks aimed at reviving the 2015 nuclear accord. The leader has dismissed the proposals by the U.S. during the negotiations.
و تحقیرآمیزی است که قابل نگاه کردن حتی با companies.
Iran has made it clear that it will only return to its commitment under the accord once it has verified that all imposed, reimposed, and relabeled U.S. sanctions against Tehran are removed. However, U.S. media have cited a source close to America's top nuclear negotiator, Robert Malley, in Vienna, as saying that Washington is opposed to the removal of all sanctions imposed on Iran. According to the article by the Foreign Policy magazine, Washington is willing to only remove sanctions outlined in the nuclear deal, but sanctions not inconsistent with the JCPOA will remain in place. That would mean the United States is seeking to divide anti-Iran sanctions into removable, irremovable, and negotiable sanctions. However, that could strike a heavy blow against the talks in Vienna to revive the deal, as far as removal of all sanctions is the only way to salvage the negotiations from collapse.
I've read several instances in American mainstream media referring to Robert Malley's effort right now as trying to strike what they're referring to as a Goldilocks-style deal to return to the JCPOA. And what is meant by that is a deal that is neither too hot or too cold, that strikes some sort of balance or that is just right. The sanctions that the United States has placed on Iran are illegal under international law. It is a fact that they were purposefully muddled and conflated with terrorism to make their lifting more difficult. And so this is just going to be something that the United States government is going to have to work out to bring itself back into compliance with the deal that it signed in 2015 and United Nations Resolution 2231.
Last week, the European Union sanctioned 8 Iranian commanders and 3 entities over so-called human rights violations. The move was a big shock for Tehran, as it is involved in EU-mediated talks to revive the JCPOA. Iranian chief nuclear negotiator Abbas Araghchi lashed out at EU sanctions, saying they have undermined the talks in Vienna.
And we told them that even your human rights sanctions that you imposed 2 days ago, we consider as JCPOA-related sanctions, because right in the middle of negotiations, you decided to impose sanctions. And that is certainly to undermine the current negotiations and to undermine JCPOA altogether. So as far as you are concerned, this is in fact a significant non-performance by European Union to impose new sanctions or new designations, as they call it.
Also, the Iranian Foreign Minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, slammed the EU for imposing sanctions on Iran instead of condemning America's economic terrorism against 82 million Iranians and the incident at Natanz nuclear facility.
This proves that the EU has no place in the world. It proves that not only the EU follows U.S. policies, but it also follows the most extremist groups inside the U.S. and Israel.
The top Iranian diplomat called the EU sanctions destructive, saying Iran will respond to this action by imposing bans on European individuals.
I think that the most recent round of sanctions applied by the EU to Iran are purely to be used as a bargaining chip in the current talks in Vienna. The EU has not placed sanctions on Iran since 2013, and so therefore this application of sanctions against members of Iran's military coming now right in the middle of these very tendentious talks within Vienna, albeit so far constructive, is a clear sign that the EU is once again fulfilling its role as a vassal entity for the United States.
On Friday, Tehran announced that it has increased its nuclear activities despite the sabotage attack, and its first batch of 60% enriched uranium was ready at Natanz nuclear facility. While the U.S. seems to try to use the sanctions and the acts of sabotage as leverage in the negotiations on the 2015 nuclear deal, Iran has taken back the momentum by making that announcement on Friday. Iran says it will not pay attention to Washington's rhetoric and that the ball is in the U.S. court to revive the deal, if it really wants to do so.
The United States under President Joe Biden has taken a tougher stance against Russia. On Thursday, Biden said Washington is facing a national emergency accusing Russia of interference in the 2020 U.S. presidential election and involvement in a major cyber espionage operation. Biden signed an executive order imposing sweeping sanctions against several Russian individuals and institutions, requiring the Treasury Department to block U.S. financial institutions from purchasing bonds from the Central Bank of the Russian Federation, the National Wealth Fund of the Russian Federation, or the Ministry of Finance of the Russian Federation after June 14, and from lending funds to these institutions. Also, the U.S. said it's expelling 10 personnel from Russia's diplomatic mission, claiming that some of them are representatives of intelligence services. But at the same time, the U.S. president called for de-escalation with Russia.
The way forward is through thoughtful dialogue and diplomatic process. The U.S. is prepared to continue constructively to move forward that process. My bottom line is this. Where there's an interest in the United States to work with Russia, we should and we will. Where Russia seeks to violate the interests of the United States, we will respond.
Shortly after the announcement, the North Atlantic Council, the political decision-making body within NATO, released a statement in support of the U.S. measures.
Well, it seems to me that it's more appropriate, and probably has been done, for the Russians to declare a national emergency, because they are the ones that are threatened, not the U.S. The U.S. is intervening in a crisis which it helped to create through the support given during the Obama years to the color revolution in Ukraine, which was directed primarily against Russia on behalf of the Western intelligence forces, who felt, in the words of Brzezinski, that if Russia loses Ukraine, they become very weak.
The developments come amid heightened tensions in eastern Ukraine, where pro-Russian forces and the Ukrainian military have clashed in recent weeks. Moscow said it will ban a string of top officials from U.S. President Joe Biden's administration, including his chief domestic policy advisor Susan Rice, from entering Russia. The Russian Foreign Ministry said U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland, FBI Chief Christopher Wray, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, and several other officials will be barred. The ministry said the officials participated in the anti-Russian push of the U.S. politics. The U.S. ambassador to Moscow is also being asked to leave the country.
President Vladimir Putin's top foreign policy aide, Yuri Ushakov, has recommended that U.S. envoy John Sullivan leave for Washington to conduct serious consultations.
Lavrov said Russia would ask 10 U.S. diplomats to leave the country in a tit-for-tat move. He said the activity of American funds and NGOs in Russia that interfere in the country's internal affairs would also be seized. Lavrov added that Moscow is also considering, quote, painful measures against U.S. businesses in Russia.
The policy as it's now formed is aimed at really reducing Russia as a major power. They're doing it primarily economically, but also I think what they want is they will not accept a Russia led by Vladimir Putin, but they want regime change. So it's really to create a world in which the United States sets the rules.
It appears that the U.S. and Russia are heading towards another Cold War. The possible crisis, however, could prove even costlier than the first for both sides.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The limelight.
U.S. leadership has stumbled from one military debacle to another, a trajectory mirroring the sad finales of other historical imperial powers, says Chris Hedges, writer, in an article titled The Collapse of American Empire. Stay tuned for the details, please. America's defeat in Afghanistan is one in a string of catastrophic military blunders that herald the death of the American empire. The United States political and military leadership has stumbled from one military debacle to another. Korea, Vietnam, Lebanon, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Libya. The trajectory of military fiascos mirrors the sad finales of the American empire. Imperial ineptitude is matched by domestic ineptitude. The collapse of good government at home, with legislative, executive, and judicial systems all seized by corporate power, ensures that the incompetent and the corrupt, those dedicated not to the national interest, but to swelling the profits of the oligarchic elite, lead the U.S. into a cul-de-sac. Rulers and military leaders, driven by venal self-interest, are often buffoonish characters in a grand comic operetta. How else to think of Alan Dulles, Dick Cheney, George W. Bush, Donald Trump, or the hapless Joe Biden? While their intellectual and moral vacuity is often darkly amusing, it is murderous and savage when directed towards their victims. There is not a single case since 1941 when the coups, political assassinations, election fraud, black propaganda, blackmail, kidnapping, brutal counterinsurgency campaigns, U.S. sanctioned massacres, torture in global black sites, proxy wars, or military interventions carried out by the U.S. resulted in the establishment of a democratic government. The two-decade-long wars in the West Asia region, the greatest strategic blunder in American history, have only left In their wake, one failed state after another. Yet no one in the ruling class is held accountable. War, when it is waged to serve utopian absurdities, such as implanting a client government in different parts of the world, descends into a quagmire. The massive allocation of money and resources to the U.S. military, which includes Biden's request for $715 billion for the Defense Department in the fiscal year 2020, an $11.3 billion or 1.6% increase over 2021, is not in the end about national defense. The bloated military budget is designed, as Seymour Melman explained in his book, the permanent war economy, primarily to keep the American economy from collapsing, or we really make anyone more weapons. The liberal interventionists, because they wrap themselves in high ideals, are responsible for numerous military and foreign policy debacles. The call by liberal interventionists such as Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, Susan Rice, and Samantha Power to fund terrorists in Syria and depose Muammar Gaddafi in Libya rent these countries, as in Afghanistan and Iraq, into warring fiefdoms. The liberal interventionists are also the tip of the spear in the campaign to ratchet up tensions with China and Russia. The core belief of imperialists, whether they come in the form of a Barack Obama or a George W. Bush, is racism and ethnic chauvinism, the notion that Americans are permitted, because of superior attributes, to impose their values on lesser races and peoples by force. This racism carried out in the name of Western civilization and its corollary white supremacy unites the rabid imperialists and liberal interventionists in the Republican and Democratic parties. U.S. decades-long military fiascos, a feature of all late empires, are called micromilitarism. The poverty of half the nation and concentration of wealth in the hands of a tiny oligarchic cabal, the wanton murder of unarmed civilians by militarized police, the rage at the ruling elites, expressed with nearly half the electorate voting for a con artist and a demagogue, and a mob of his supporters storming the Capitol, are the internal signs of disintegration in the U.S. The inability of the for-profit National Health Services to cope with the pandemic, the passage of a COVID relief bill, and the proposal of an infrastructure bill that would hand the bulk of some $5 trillion to corporations while tossing crumbs, one-time checks of $1,400 to a citizenry in deep financial distress, will only fuel the decline in the U.S. Because of the loss of unionized jobs, the real decline of wages, deindustrialization, chronic underemployment and unemployment, and punishing austerity programs, the U.S. is plagued by a plethora of diseases of despair, including opioid addictions, alcoholism, suicides, gambling, depression, morbid obesity, and mass shootings. These are the consequences of a deeply troubled society. And worse, the loss of the dollar as the world's reserve currency will instantly raise the cost of imports. It will result in unemployment of Depression-era levels. It will force the empire to dramatically contract. It will, as the economy worsens, fuel a hyper-nationalism that will most likely be expressed through a fascism. The mechanisms already in place for total social control, militarized police, a suspension of civil liberties, wholesale government surveillance, enhanced terrorism laws that railroad people into the world's largest prison system, and censorship overseen by the digital media monopolies will seamlessly cement into place a police state. Nations that descend into crises this severe seek to deflect the rage of a betrayed population on foreign scapegoats. The defeat in Afghanistan is a familiar and sad story. One, all those blinded by imperial hubris endure. The tragedy, however, is not the collapse of the American empire, but taking that, lacking the ability to engage in self-critique and self-correction. As it dies, it will lash out in a blind, in chaos fury at innocence at home and abroad.
Around the World with Reporters.
Signatories of the Iran nuclear deal end their fifth session in 2 weeks amid efforts to revive the agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. Two working groups have been formed, one to draft a list of measures that need to be taken by Iran, and another to outline the sanctions that have to be removed by the U.S. Now, a third expert group will be working on the matter of sequence. Iran's lead delegate, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, said that would be the focus of talks when they resume next week.
Next week, the important question is to talk about the sequence, because we have already talked about measures, and we have now focus more on the question of sequence to make sure that the U.S., who has left the JCPOA, should come back first, should lift all its sanctions first, and then Iran would follow after the verification.
Although no direct talks have taken place between Iran and the U.S., the American delegation has been engaged in discussions with the other parties, including Britain, France, Germany, Russia, and China.
The top priority remains to focus on sanction lifting. In this particular context, the U.S. must lift all its sanctions, may it concern Iran or any third party, in thorough, complete, and straightforward manner.
Before leaving Vienna for Tehran, Araghchi said Iran does not want to prolong the negotiations, but also needs to take the time to work on every single word that's being drafted to come up with a specific formula allowing both Iran and the U.S. to come back to full compliance. Iran says the talks are on the right track and moving forward, but as the EU coordinator put it, there's still a lot of work to be done. Omar Lizki, Vienna.
Tensions between the United States and Russia appear to be ratcheting up in recent weeks over a range of issues, including Ukraine. The Russian Defense Ministry on Tuesday accused the U.S. and NATO of engaging in what it described as provocative activities in the waters and airspace of the Black Sea. Moscow also accused Kiev of trying to destabilize the situation in the eastern Donbass region. Amid escalating tensions, Washington and its NATO allies have rallied behind Kiev. They voiced concern over Russia's troop deployment along its borders with Ukraine, claiming Russia might be planning to invade the country. But Moscow said the military buildup was in response to cold, threatening military action by NATO and nothing more. Washington-Moscow tensions heightened after the U.S. administration announced a new array of anti-Russia sanctions last Thursday. The White House claimed the sanctions were in retaliation for a range of Russia's actions, including its alleged meddling in the U.S. election, cyber espionage, and action in Ukraine. The Kremlin responded with tit-for-tat measures. But the hostile attitude of the U.S. and its allies is not limited to Russia. They have also collectively formed and launched a pressure campaign against China. Just last month, the U.S., along with the European Union, Britain, and Canada, imposed coordinated actions on Beijing under the pretext of human rights violations. The United States and China have also been embroiled in dispute over a host of issues ranging from trade, Hong Kong, and Taiwan. Beijing has time and again accused Washington of seeking to destabilize mainland China by interfering in the affairs of Hong Kong and Chinese Taipei, as well as fomenting tensions in the South China Sea. The country last week escalated its military activities after the U.S. announced it would deploy its warships to the region. The Chinese president on Tuesday also criticized the hegemonic power structures in the global governance, calling for the rejection of such moves.
The
future of the world should be mastered by all countries in the world. Rules made by a single country or just a few countries cannot be forcibly applied on others. The world order cannot be led by unilateralism from some country.
The growing tension between Washington on the one side and Moscow and Beijing on the other is bringing the two countries even closer. U.S. President Joe Biden will probably face a nightmare scenario given deepening ties and strategic cooperation between China and Russia, the countries Washington think is a threat to its global interests.
Northern Ireland is bracing itself for more potential trouble. Peaceful pop-up protests across the region in the coming days. An opportunity, some say, to catch police by surprise and block major roads for a time. They follow days of riots and violent clashes earlier this month that plunged the city of Belfast and parts of Northern Ireland into a crisis not seen since the dark days of the Troubles that started in the late 1960s and led to nearly three decades of bloodshed.
There will be protests around the north of Ireland, but what's worrying is that there's a lot of disinformation also. What we're seeing here is a hidden hand in trying to raise tensions between the Catholic and Protestant communities. And when we see this, these things happening, we always have to remember that when there's a void there, extremists fill that void. And when the extremists are there to fill that void, we always see the hidden hand of British security services.
Tensions have been rising since Brexit, which many warned would threaten the Good Friday Agreement of 1998 that put an end to the Troubles. The implementation of the Northern Ireland Protocol allowed the UK to leave the EU without setting up a border on the island of Ireland. Instead, the UK and EU agreed to a customs border between Britain and Northern Ireland. Now, the loyalist and unionist communities who wish to remain under British rule are demanding the protocol be scrapped.
This would seriously destabilize the peace and brought us back to somewhere that was pre-1998 and something that we as a society didn't want to see.
The riots were also fueled by the country's police chief's refusal to resign after a decision not to prosecute Sinn Féin politicians for attending a large funeral last year against COVID restrictions.
I don't see why Simon Byrne would have resigned. I think that he gave his report to those that would have made that decision within the PPS. And you know, once he has passed that on, there's not much he can do after that. He made recommendations.
Efforts are underway for a political settlement of tensions, including a call for dialogue among all sides from the U.S. president. Still, fears of more unrest and violence are in the air. Said Bourizza, London.
The EU's top diplomat, Josep Borrell, updated the bloc's 27 foreign affairs ministers on the latest state of play regarding talks in Vienna to try and save the Iran nuclear deal. He told them that discussions have become less general and more focused, particularly regarding U.S. sanctions against Iran and the Islamic Republic's nuclear energy program.
I talked with Secretary of State Blinken last week when he was in Brussels. I also talked with Minister Sharif. I think that both parts are really interested in reaching an agreement.
Borrell talks about an agreement, but critics say the EU has been much too soft on the US. After all, an agreement was reached in 2015. It was endorsed by the UN.
only the US broke the terms of the accord when Donald Trump took Washington out of the deal almost 3 years ago.
With Iran, we'll see what happens.
Analysts say in those 3 years, the EU, as coordinator of the deal, officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, failed to stand up to Trump. Representatives from Iran, Russia, China, France, Britain, Germany, and the European Commission are attempting to preserve the accord during negotiations in the Austrian capital. US officials are there on the sidelines of the talks. Given that the nuclear deal is underpinned by UN Resolution 2231, the vast majority of diplomats agree it should be respected.
We are 193 member states of the United Nations. Of course, the United States, as you've rightly pointed out, is a powerful member state, but they are a member state. And so we need to rally the numbers against those that may have different opinions.
Some citizens we've been talking to say Tel Aviv is behind efforts to derail the nuclear agreement.
Israel have interest and Israel are kind of pushing America.
Frankly, what we need is more peace and not more warmongering.
Tehran insists the only way the issue can be resolved is if Washington lifts all of its illegal sanctions. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Imposed more tight restrictions to fight the spread of the coronavirus. Earlier, Turkish president said that the daily lockdown during the first 2 weeks of the holy month of Ramadan will start at 7 p.m. instead of 9 p.m. The lockdown will last till 5 a.m. every day, as the weekend lockdown will continue with stricter measures and more police officers present in the streets to make sure citizens and residents are abiding by the rules. During the weekend, security forces in all 81 provinces were out to make sure people are not violating the lockdown. Tourists are the only ones allowed to be outside during the lockdowns. In Istanbul alone, some 20,000 policemen took part in this campaign. Turkish Interior Minister threatened to punish those who do not respect the rules.
We will be out with our full force. Foreigners with residency permits are also subjected to restrictions and lockdowns, and they have to obey the rules just like others. I have the authority to revoke the residency permits of those who try to exploit the situation, pretending to be tourists. We will not let this happen.
The death toll in Turkey surged last month when restrictions were relaxed. Some blame the people who didn't act responsibly. Others blame the government for taking decisions based on the economic needs of the country rather than what is better for people's health. Analysts believe the government must take stricter measures. However, it is the economic situation that is preventing it from doing so.
The government is doing its best against the pandemic, but unfortunately the cases are rising because the country cannot afford full closure of businesses. Therefore, semi-closure is the only solution, and people must be more responsible.
Turkish Health Ministry said 20 million vaccine jabs have been distributed across the country. This is as Turkey says it has potentially developed a vaccine that just entered the phase of human trials. Turkish Industry and Technology Minister Mustafa Varank has volunteered for the trials. Turkish government wants to welcome tourists again after the holy month of Ramadan. However, many believe it is still too soon for this step, as only 25% of citizens have been vaccinated. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
After mass scenes of a failed security operation against thousands of protesters demanding the expulsion of French ambassador from Pakistan, the public resentment pitched high when the police launched operation against the protesters in the eastern city of Lahore. At the heart of public outrage is the revoking of a 6-month-old agreement by the government with Tehreek-e-Labbaik Pakistan, or the TLP, a political and religious group. The TLP championed the cause to expel French ambassador over repeated incident of blasphemy of Muslim Prophet Muhammad and their official patronage by the French government. The TLP supporters allegedly attacked a police station in Lahore and kidnapped 11 policemen, including senior official. Later on, the protesters release all the police officials. The police says an oil tanker with over 50,000 liters of fuel was also taken away by the protesters, which caused ripples within the corridors of power of its possible explosion. A strong public reaction once again forced the government to halt its security operation. There were countrywide wheel jam strikes and closure of businesses after many opposition parties and other religious groups announced to support the TLP's demand to expel French ambassador.
How long we would put up with incidents like burning of Holy Quran? How long we would put up with blasphemy being committed against our Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him? But now we have decided not to tolerate it any longer.
Alarmed by public backlash, Prime Minister Imran Khan struggled hard in his live address to the nation to calm down public anger.
When Muslim countries stand up together and collectively boycott trade with France over blasphemy incidents, then it would have an impact. I would lead this campaign internationally now to prevent incidents of blasphemy.
Pakistan banned TLP last week, declaring it a terrorist organization in a country where violence against the police has become a norm by almost all major political parties to press their demands.
The government has resumed negotiation with the TLP, which is not ready to settle down on anything short of the expulsion of French ambassador from Pakistan. Now the TLP seems to be on a far more strong footing after a failed security operation against them. Therefore, analysts believe that the government is also running out of options but to withdraw its decision to ban it. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The factory in the south of Tehran, where a new vaccine named Osvit would be produced within a few months to immune people against the deadly coronavirus. The name is taken from the pharmaceutical company that is developing the vaccine in collaboration with a knowledge-based firm. The joint project will soon be tested on humans to be mass-produced in the capital, Tehran.
Given that the initial phases of the Osvit-19 are completed and the earlier stages, including the animal phase, were carried out on rats and monkeys successfully, we need to launch this mass production line, and now we are prepared.
I asked the officials whether the formula is imported from other countries or it is indigenous, and this was the answer.
Not even a single word of the 420-page project of the vaccine has been non-native. It's fully developed in Iran. We took samples from the first patients at the beginning of the pandemic. Then it was characterized, inactivated, and cultivated. The job has been a very complicated teamwork and totally indigenous.
Right now, the company is producing the vials, and as the manager said, they can produce up to 6,000 every hour. They also told us that there is a capacity to produce about 20 million doses of the jab in a year. After the official ceremony in which the vial was unveiled, the vice president for science and technology launched the production line.
Within the past few years, very good things have been achieved in the domain of vaccine production in the country. This year, we have several corona vaccines to be mass-produced. This vial production line is a very important infrastructure for other companies that are developing the vaccine.
The Osvit vaccine must be injected in two stages with a three-week interval.
Iran says the second phase of vaccination against COVID-19 will begin in early May, and at this stage, about 15 million people would be vaccinated against the coronavirus. To this end, the country needs about 30 million doses of the vaccine, out of which a great number will be homemade ones. Fuman Abedi, Tehran.
America's longest war in Afghanistan is going to end as Washington has pledged to pull out its forces from the country in 5 months. Apart from other consequences of Washington's war in Afghanistan, casualties caused by the conflict over the past two decades showed that almost 90,000 Afghan and U.S. military forces, more than 70,000 civilians, and over 84,000 terrorists have lost their lives since 2001. The main cause behind such casualties is said to be Washington's failures, including taking the Taliban not so seriously. Although weak presence of Taliban was seen in remote villages of Afghanistan in 2001, it slowly expanded its maneuver area to big cities by launching bomb attacks or complex assaults in and after 2005.
The attacks mostly claimed the lives of civilians. In response, Afghan and foreign troops launched more military operations, especially air strikes, increasing human losses in the country. Now that Washington has realized there is no military solution to the Afghan war, U.S. President Joe Biden announced on Wednesday that all U.S. troops will leave the war-torn country by September 11, the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. The Afghan government strongly believes that the Taliban will never be able to take control over the country militarily due to high capabilities of Afghan National Armed Troops in the fight against terrorism.
The Afghan Defense Ministry, in close cooperation with other government bodies, is fully ready to confront the worst-case scenario. Concerns of some international intelligence agencies are because of the security of their own countries. But we are not worried, because we are now capable enough to defend our nation.
Meneha also argued that the only way to put an end to bloodshed in Afghanistan is the establishment of a united front by Afghan people without being dependent on foreign players, and convince the Taliban to lay down their arms.
The time has arrived for all Afghans to come together and set aside differences in order to use the ongoing peace process as an opportunity for the country to see peace and stability after decades-long war and violence.
While all players are waiting for the launch of Turkey's summit on the Afghan peace process, the Taliban say they are not willing to attend it because the U.S. violated the terms of the agreement signed between the two in Doha, February last year. Based on the Doha agreement, U.S. military forces have to leave Afghanistan by May 1st. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
A show of military might. Different units of the Islamic Republic of Iran's army paraded the forces' latest military equipment on the National Army Day. In Tehran, commanders of the Army's Air Force, Navy, and Ground Force, as well as senior commanders of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, were present to oversee the event. Ahead of the ceremonies, a message from leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, was read out, where he praised the contributions the Army has made to the security of the country. Army officials say serving the Iranian people is their top priority.
In fact, through these parades, we seek to send messages to our nation. We want to tell our people that we will continue to stand with you to ensure your peace and security, just as we have done over the past four decades.
The parades featured the latest military achievements and weaponry of the Iranian army, including radars, tanks, armored vehicles, and fighter jets. The highlight was the latest drones, missiles, and missile systems that are developed inside the country, including Sayyad and Mirsad missile systems. The Islamic Republic provides for 80% of its defensive needs domestically. Officials say the country owes this to four decades of arms embargoes imposed on the country by the U.S. and its allies.
What we did in the past four decades was to look at the sanctions as an opportunity to rely on our own resources. We discovered new potentials inside the country, and here we are today producing nearly every essential military equipment, from missiles to UAVs. So today, our security is not tied to foreign arms suppliers.
The National Army Day was designated in 1979, following a historic speech by late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini. Back then, he thanked the army for its role in the victory of the Islamic Revolution by announcing its neutrality, as the former Pahlavi regime pushed commanders to suppress the revolution. Every year, this massive parade sends strong messages of security to Iranians and the region. But on top of all the messages, the annual occasion is widely interpreted as the army's renewed support for the Islamic establishment. Where officials say, with or without sanctions, the Iranian armed forces continue to defend the country's sovereignty. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.